Not all meals are created equal. For instance, breakfast has the spicy egg McMuffin for a limited time, and lunch doesn't. McDonald's breakfast comes first. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Professor Benjamin Karp of Brooklyn College of CUNY Graduate Center, professor of history. His new book, The Great New York Fire of 1776, A Lost Story of the American Revolution. We're building the details before the fire because the decision for everyone to make is, was it on purpose? The Battle of Long Island is late August of 1776. Washington's forces are badly outflanked and put to flight. It's a miracle of the wind that Washington is able to leave Long Island without being captured with his soldiers and escape to Manhattan. And so, Professor, we come now to late August, early September, Washington's army in New York City, and knowing the British have an enormous force that is going to start landing soon enough. The Howes, however, are not looking to punish the rebels. It's important here to emphasize the Howe brothers had another understanding of how to solve a rebellion. Why did they hesitate? Why didn't they destroy the army immediately? What did they think could happen?
Well, I mean, historians disagree about this, but I think the consensus is beginning to develop that, you know, William Howe, at least, had witnessed the Battle of Bunker Hill, and he never knew, you know, what kind of force he was going to face on the other side of a hill. He didn't necessarily want to commit a bunch of his forces in a way that would lead to a mass casualty event, because he is not going to be able to request unlimited amounts of troops from back home. And so he tried to be cautious with his army. He definitely wanted to win a decisive victory against Washington and destroy Washington's army in order to undermine the rebellion. But he also was cautious and, you know, and not necessarily willing to, you know, do something that he thought might lead to massive amounts of casualties.
And they were offering pardons. And my memory is they offered a pardon to anyone who gave up the rebel cause. July 14th, they offered a pardon, and my memory is they offered one in mid-September before the fire. So they were looking to persuade as opposed to punish the rebel army. Was it successful?
Yeah, well, they're trying to do both, right? They also have a peace commission from Parliament. They do want to see reconciliation on happier terms. They have this idea that many Americans are loyalist in their heart and only waiting for the British army to show up to give up on any allegiance to Congress and come back into the arms of King George III. They turn out to be wrong about that. But it is possible that if they had won even more decisive victories than they had, that their dreams of reconciliation might have come true in the fall of 1776.
Now we come to the evidence that the professor has gathered together for us from diaries, from letters, from memories, from an investigation that was conducted by the Crown in 1783, 7 years after. My notes, Professor, forgive me if I get some of these dates wrong, but we're looking at September 5th, Nathaniel Greene with Washington clearly writes, burn the city. September 6th, John Hancock, president of the Congress, clearly writes to Washington, take every measure to prevent the city being burned. I note those two. There are other voices here. Who are they talking to, and who had the ultimate decision? General Greene was a very important man. Very powerful man in Washington's army. We'll see him perform at the Battle of Trenton at year's end. Well thought of, goes on to serve as leader of the government. And John Hancock is president of Congress. So these are push-pull. What did Washington make of these voices?
Yeah, Greene, it's hard to know how widespread the sentiment was in Washington's officer corps that he should burn the city. But Washington himself, as he later confesses in a letter to his cousin, he was convinced by the arguments that New York City should have been burned. And Congress, at least on paper, tells him not to. And he later says that this was a terrible error, a capital error, you know, that Congress should have given him permission to burn New York City. Now, so, I mean, and Washington sees the advantages and disadvantages on both sides. On the one hand, if he burns the city, he's able to deprive the British of their winter quarters. On the other hand, if he burns the city, it will do a lot of property damage, and that might not necessarily make the American cause look good. And Washington was very concerned with his reputation, and he didn't necessarily want to take responsibility for burning New York City all on his own. Many historians emphasize how deferential Washington was to the civilian authority. On the other hand, Congress is not sitting right on top of his shoulder. They're at a distance, and they tended to give Washington leeway to make his own decisions and not necessarily micromanage him at every step.
On September 11th, these scenes, you can't make them up, Ben. John Adams, Ben Franklin, and Edward Rutledge meet Howe on board Howe's flagship for 3 hours talking about resolving this. Did the subject of don't burn it, burn it, what is going to happen, did it come up in that conversation? Do we have good notes from that?
Not that I know of. I don't know that it came up in that conversation.
And the peace negotiation was not successful. Well, if John Adams is there, there's no surrendering. I understand that. What is Howe's opinion at this point about the vulnerability of New York to burning? To my knowledge, at this point, the rebel cause, the patriot cause, has never been accused of burning a city at this point, although there was talk of setting fires. So is the debate continuing on the loyalists on the Continental Army side, or is this just one-off diary notes?
Yeah, I mean, well, the Americans had burned a city by this point. On New Year's Day and in the weeks afterwards, the rebels had destroyed Norfolk, Virginia, which was the sixth largest town in the colonies at the time. The British had begun by cannonading it, but then Virginia and North Carolina militiamen come in and burn about 85% of Norfolk. So, but they are able to cover this up. And so the public at large does not necessarily know that it was the Americans that were principally responsible. For the most part, the newspapers say, oh, the British had burned Norfolk, and let's add that to our list of grievances against King George III. So the Americans were capable of burning a city, and the Loyalists and the British are definitely passing around a lot of rumors saying, as soon as the Americans leave this place, they are going to burn New York City to deprive us of the advantages of it.
On the 14th, George Washington moves his headquarters to Coogan's Bluff. That's the Polo Grounds, to a house that has been left behind by two loyalists, Roger Morris and his wife. And we're going to turn now to what happens after the 14th. The fire is going to begin, but not definitively and not certainly. There's a lot of debate here as to where it, and when it begins, and that's critical. Also, the conditions. The Great New York Fire of 1776, A Lost Story of the American Revolution, Professor Benjamin L. Karp of Brooklyn College and CUNY Graduate Center is the author. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
What if your top salesperson was 1,000 times more efficient? And what if a limitless digital workforce helped your number one find leads? A super team working 24/7 on their behalf, thinking, acting, and solving complex tasks so more deals closed. What if with every sale, each customer felt like they were the only customer? That would be one very efficient sales leader. Now, imagine if every person on your team worked to the power of 1,000. They can with Agentforce, the powerful AI from Salesforce.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
There's a time and a place for Filet-O-Fish, but breakfast is for sausage biscuits. McDonald's breakfast comes first. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.